You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, August 24th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is hump day. And today on the program, David Dayan from Fire Dog Lake, going to tell us the ins and outs of this pressure on Schneiderman. If the story continues, Eric Schneiderman, New York Attorney General, pursuing investigations of the banks and their fraudulent mortgage practices and more, I suspect. And he's getting pushback from all different quarters. Well, I guess some specific quarters is more accurate. Also, Amanda Turkle from Huffington Post on the latest attempt by progressives to fight back via statewide referendum or referendi. And then later in the program, it may be in the better half of the show, folks. I just don't know. Hopefully we'll have time. Yesterday we recorded an interview with David Cross, and he turned out to be our earthquake correspondent for the massive earthquake, which covered something like, a quarter of the country, more.
Yeah, about that. They were feeling it in North Carolina and all the way up to Massachusetts.
Toronto, upstate New York. You will hear in this interview my experience of the earthquake in particular, which was particularly distressing. I think it is safe for work. It's fairly safe for work. Ladies and gentlemen, let me just start with this before we bring on David Dayan. Dear Sam, I hope you find this information useful. I always do, folks, when you email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com. I've been listening to the podcast since before the hard launch. Although I enjoy the show, I previously felt I could live without it. Even once you went to a members-only section of the show, I didn't feel I was missing that much. E.g., I don't really need to know the latest on your daughter's broken arm. Interesting, though, it may be. Well, sir, you obviously do. It was a buckle fracture of the wrist. The format of the podcast also doesn't let you do what I like best from the old Radio Majority Report, which was to slap down the unending torrent of right-wing callers with well-reasoned arguments. True that. Still could be something in the future. I think we have our marketing department needs to get out there and corral these right-wingers. What finally motivated me to become a member was last night's Rachel Maddow show. It was interesting. I read this because I was watching it, and I had the exact same feeling, as he will express. After covering the breaking news on the East Coast earthquake and the Libyan revolution, just like the rest of the media, her show reached a new low point with a whole segment of in-depth political analysis comparing the Republican candidates to the cast of Gilligan's Island. To be honest with you, I had it on and I sort of checked out. I do remember, like, they were talking about the Baucus character, the Jim Baucus character. What was his name again? The Lovey. Yeah, I totally lost it at that. I wasn't sure if he was running or what the deal was. Comparing the really sad part is ever since her return from vacation, she's been almost exclusively covering the Republican horse race for an election that is still over a year away. Again, just like everybody else. Now that countdown isn't podcast, and Maddow is no longer interested in covering relevant news. Keystone XL pipeline, Verizon strike, Israeli civil uprising, unrest at town halls, etc. All stories which we have covered quite well. In fact, I've yet to get to the Verizon story today, but I will. I've come to rely on the Majority Report as one of my sources for the news that tends to fly under the radar of the corporate media, and for honest political analysis that doesn't twist itself into pretzels, trying to cheerlead absolutely everything Obama does. That's why I finally subscribed. Well, thank you, new listener. No, I should say old listener, new subscriber, Martin. You know, I'll tell you something. I had that very thought as I was watching Maddow last night, that if I was to get a TV show, I am sure I would have to do that, which is why I am so thankful that on this program I don't. I am completely funded by the members. And if we have this amount of members in 3, 6, 9, 12 months, I'm not going to be able to do it. I had the projections. We're off the projections for the show, not dramatically, but enough. And I had household projections that were slightly thrown off base, as I've said in the past, because Nikki, the job that she had went away. So if you value this show, become a member. And I'll tell you something, the better half of this show has changed. I still occasionally will talk about Mila and her arm and Justin Bieber. And I will still talk about, stuff that's not necessarily news-oriented, that's more just enjoyable. But I'm doing more and more stories in the other half because it's just not enough time. And frankly, you know, the existence of the show is reliant on that. And don't make me go to a situation where you only get two shows a week for free, because that would be that's beneath all of us. And I don't want to go there. Folks, we got to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to be talking to David Dayan right after this brief interlude. We are back on the Majority Report on the phone. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome back to the program David Dayan of Fire Dog Lake News. David, I have to tell you, I cannot remember who I had this conversation with, but we were both marveling at your capacity to cover so much and know so much about it. I still have a theory that you're not one person. But however you manage your whatever you got going there under your cottage industry that is David Dayan, that's fine.
You were probably talking to a member of my family.
Yeah, I bet. We'll see how long that lasts, buddy. All right, well, let's get into this, because I've been covering it, but I feel like there's a lot more going on here. And Eric Schneiderman has been under a tremendous amount of pressure, it seems to me. He was just recently kicked off this committee. Tell us, just round this whole story up for us.
Okay. So basically, you have to go back to last October, when all of these allegations of robo-signing and improper foreclosure practices by the major banks were found. And there was a lot of consternation around this. The state attorneys general all 50 of them, said, we're going to start an investigation. And in the ensuing 9 months, they have promptly moved right to the settlement and way past the investigation part of this investigation. And that's essentially all that Schneiderman is calling for. He's saying that, we have this situation where the banks missed on their securitization practices in putting together the mortgage-backed securities and could have created fraud in that case, poor wrong representations and warrants. They have been defrauding state courts through robo-signing, forgeries, illegal representations, the inability to show standing to foreclose, that they actually own the properties that they're foreclosing on. And let's have the investigation. Let's actually do the work of seeing how wide and deep this thing goes before we rush into a settlement when we don't even know what we're settling on.
And we should say that these are ongoing practices too, right? I mean, it's not like the robo-signing has ended. They're still doing this.
It hasn't. It has not ended. Reuters and AP did stories just in the last month or so using data from registers of deeds, who are the county recorders of land title information, showing that they're still sending in documents that have, robo-signed. And a robo-signer is, of course, someone who signs thousands of foreclosure documents, and many of them have admitted through affidavits in court that they have no information, they have no insight into what they're signing. So this is against the practice because they're signing affidavits attesting to knowledge of what's in the documents, and they're saying that no, we don't really know anything about it.
Okay, so wait a sec. So the settlement would basically say we're going to waive. There will be no investigation about robo signing. They're off the hook for that. In exchange, theoretically, they should end the practice. Theoretically, and give $20 billion that they will apply to cramming down the principles of certain people's mortgages. Is that accurate?
It's accurate, but it's actually quite worse than that because the banks want a much broader release of liability. They don't just want a release on the grounds of robo-signing. They want a release on their securitization practices. They want a release on the abuse that servicers have been doing. For example, pyramiding fees and putting false fees that they then charge to the borrowers. They want a release basically on everything. They want a global settlement. They want to get rid of all their liability from state attorneys general on their foreclosure practices. And in exchange, they get this pittance sum, and then they promise not to do it ever again or something.
So $20 billion, and which is nothing. We know that like you've got $700 billion up to $1 trillion of in terms of negative equity in people's houses.
Right.
And you've got this And I don't even know if that's enough money to calculate the damages that all these practices have done, frankly.
I mean, if you applied this to every underwater borrower, you'd give them about $1,000.
Right.
That's what $20 billion. That's how far $20 billion would get you.
And
So Schneiderman, and he's not the only one. Let's say, is resisting a broad liability release. He wants to continue his investigation, which he's already initiated, in conjunction with Bo Biden, the Attorney General of Delaware, who happens to be the Vice President's son. So over the weekend, we heard about pressure that the Obama administration was putting on Schneiderman to go along with the settlement. And the rationale that they use is that we have to measure the need for an investigation against the speed that is needed to get homeowners, some relief. Now, this is a ridiculous statement because they've been talking this argument about speed versus, accuracy of an official investigation for at least, close to a year. I mean, I remember doing a report in March saying there's this argument about whether to quickly do this settlement or to undergo a full investigation. If they spent the time doing the investigation starting back in March, you know, there wouldn't be, and instead of making this argument that we have to quickly do this settlement, you know, they could have done the investigation by now on a parallel track. So that shows to me that, this isn't really about speed or helping borrowers. It's about getting the banks off the hook.
And the other, the flip side of that coin, too, is the idea that $20 billion is actually providing that relief when, in fact, you've outlined and others have outlined that there is far more than $20 billion that the executive branch, we don't need Congress, controls right now, whether it's the $40 billion in TARP, whether it's the capacity of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are wards of the state right now, to do their own principal cram down, which they could do unilaterally at this point. There's many other mechanisms that would provide far more relief for these people much quicker than that $20 billion for a settlement, and they all come essentially free.
You're absolutely right, Sam, and it's many, many times over the money that would be gained from, you know, this settlement. And I've even heard this settlement is $20 billion sort of as a headline number and would include past loan modifications that they've already done. So it's a headline-grabbing number so that they can say that they've helped the bank, helped the homeowners, and not helped the bank. Provided some relief to some borrowers. But it's not a serious effort, and if they were serious about undertaking that effort, they could have done it by now without, you know, needing to notify Congress whatsoever.
Okay, so then, to carry the story forward, the Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller, who's sort of been the lead in pushing this deal from the state side, has kicked Eric Schneiderman off the executive committee of this group that's trying to put together this deal as, for whatever reason, I'm not sure. So he doesn't poison the water, I guess, in the meetings, the well, as it were. It seems pretty silly to me.
It's so petty. Yeah, it's so petty. You know, there are 13 out of the 50 states that are on this executive committee and have been involved in some of the negotiations over the settlement with the banks, although I think only Miller and a couple others that negotiate directly with the banks. So, they threw Schneiderman off the committee. Now, Beau Biden also is on the executive committee. He's joined Schneiderman's intervention into the, investigation. He has praised Schneiderman for bringing up these issues, but he wasn't thrown off the committee.
All right, wait a second. Let's stop here because you don't have much time, and I want to get to – because this to me – all right, when I hear Beau Biden, I hear a guy who, if it's necessary and they want him to drop his argument to investigate, they probably have a way of reaching him.
They have an in.
Huh?
You know, they have an in on Biden.
They have an in on Biden. Eric Schneiderman, obviously, because he's from New York, because Wall Street's from New York – and because New York is a big state, it has a sort of a big reputation of strong attorney generals in the past, that if he was to drop his problems, it would probably cause others to also drop their it would be harder for other people to hold out against this. But let me ask you this.
I think that's right.
Do you think that's where it ends? In other words, when I see the other sort of parallel track, first off, we have the Department of Justice that is supposedly pressuring him. We have Sean Donovan, the head of HUD, who is also pressuring him. Now, it's one thing to say the Department of Justice should have some independence, and maybe Obama doesn't have the ability to have any sway over Eric Holder. But I'm sorry, Sean Donovan is not doing this on his own. HUD is not like this bastion of independence. But when I also hear that a New York Fed director, Catherine Wild, who also freelances essentially for what appears to me to be a lobby group for banks, or at least businesses in New York, is also pressuring Schneiderman, is this about this settlement, or do you think that there's other investigations that Schneiderman's doing that they're already trying to lay the groundwork to go after this guy?
Well, that could be. I mean, certainly this settlement is the biggest thing that, I would say bank defenders or banking interests or any kind of corporate interest want to get behind them. I mean, this is a huge deal. And if you don't have New York in this deal, you don't have a settlement, because so much of this is governed by New York laws. As you say, Wall Street's from New York. Most of the mortgage-backed securities were put together and governed by New York state trust law. If you don't have New York on this deal, you don't have a deal. So I think it's not too much more than that, although, Schneiderman has been very active in some other things around fracking and around some other issues. And certainly getting him to play ball on this might help them in the other respects. But, you know, I really don't think he's going to give this up. I mean, he has been he hasn't been trying this in the press, first of all.
Right.
This is not some sort of aggrandizing movement on the part of Schneiderman or looking to the next election or something. I mean, he has, to a fault, maybe not made appearances outside of court, not defended his own record outside of statements from a spokesman. He is interested in, I think, the pursuit of justice in this case. And that really kind of should be commended, rather than these petty things of throwing him off the clubhouse or whatever it was that Tom Miller did. I tend to think that this settlement is doomed. If it was not a settlement that was completely overbroad, if the banks would have accepted that, it would have been done by now. If the attorneys general would have accepted one that gives full liability release, also, it would have been done by now. I think this settlement isn't going to happen. I think it might happen on a very limited level. Hopefully, Schneiderman will be persuaded to continue to go along with his investigations, and we can get to the bottom of this.
One last point, because I guess, there's just something that gets making me tingle about this story a little bit. When I see Lloyd Blankenfein lawyer up, ostensibly because of the report that came out of that Senate committee headed by Carl Levin, and ostensibly because of the sort of the half-truths or misspoken aspects of his testimony in front of the Senate as to whether or not how they represented these mortgage-backed securities to their clients. I start to wonder if there isn't, like you say, Schneiderman has been extremely quiet about this. I mean, this is, I went to college in Connecticut when Joe Lieberman was the state attorney general, and it seemed like, he would take credit if it was a sunny day. There would be an ad on the on TV at the time with Joe Lieberman saying, "Hey, look, it's sunny. I'm Joe Lieberman, New York attorney general." And so he's been incredibly quiet. I wonder if this isn't just sort of the beginning of in a way to try and see if they can slow his role or get him or get anything on the books that provides some measure of immunity or protection from prosecution across the board in their actions as a way.
Well, it could
of,
well be.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be, the Blankfein thing is about lying to Congress. So that
right.
would be under more of a federal purview. Than under
well,
know,
that's what we've been.
New
that's
York
what we've been
general.
Told. Why he's dealing with a lawyer?
Right. But I mean, I think if you want to look at why they're desperate to settle, take a look at Bank of America's stock price over the last couple of weeks. I mean, Bank of America is down over 50% on the year. There were rumblings yesterday from people like Henry Blodgett talking about it's time to think about nationalization on Bank of America. They have not been able to escape their liabilities, particularly on these mortgage lawsuits from private investors. Private investors who, by the way, would not be indemnified. Like, even if they did a settlement with attorneys general, private actors could still make claims. You know, AIG just did a lawsuit against Bank of America, looking for 35% of the face value of mortgage-backed securities they said were sold to them in error. If you have that percentage, you don't have a Bank of America anymore. I mean, if investors keep suing and try to extract that much of the face value of these mortgage-backed securities. So if anyone is trying to be protected, I would say it's B of A. That would be my main point there.
All right. Well, David Dayan, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. And I know you you didn't have much time, so I appreciate your making the time for us today. We will, of course, talk to you again soon. All right, folks, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Amanda Turkle from Huffington Post. I should tell you, whereas David Dayan and I were in the same student film 19 years ago in Michigan, Amanda Turkle and I never appeared in any production together whatsoever. But I'm looking forward to talking to her. We will be right back after this. All right, folks, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Senior political reporter from Huffington Post, the Huffington Post, HuffPo, Amanda Turkle. Amanda, welcome to the program.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me.
So I read this piece that you wrote yesterday in the Huffington Post about progressives plotting ballot initiative strategy in multiple states across the country. Tell us about this. What specifically? I know there's some specific states that they're targeting right now. Tell us what those states are before we get into sort of the broader strategy here.
Sure. Well, those states are Idaho, Ohio, and Maine are the states they're looking at. And what they, I mean, conservatives took over a lot of state legislatures in 2010. I mean, they took over Congress, the House of Representatives, too, made gains all over the country. They pushed through a lot of laws, very conservative laws, and so progressives are now trying to roll some of them back at the ballot.
And so, you know, Ohio, it's fairly well known. It's SB5, and John Kasich is so worried about this that he has done as close to a 180, I think, as you can do without just fully capitulating and resigning from office on this SB5, which is essentially an attack on the bargaining rights of labor unions. How much national effort is there and was even needed in a state like Ohio, where you had almost five times as many signatures as necessary? They needed something like 250,000. They got about 1 million signatures for this ballot initiative. How much national support do you need for something like that?
I mean, we saw in Wisconsin what national support can do. It rose up at the state and local level, and then it just snowballed. And you had people coming from all over the country to support what Wisconsin was doing, and it was getting progressives excited. And so nationally, if you show what's going on in Ohio and Idaho and Maine, I think that could help progressives in 2012, saying, look, you know, we're putting real effort into fighting back what conservatives are doing, you know, these sort of right-wing initiatives that are attacking labor unions. And I think it's a way to get the grassroots and get the base excited. And of course, you know, more money, more support is always helpful when you are going to be battling a lot of, you know, conservatives, and you're going to be battling the governor and trying to get this ballot initiative passed.
Now, is this new territory for liberals? I mean, I remember in the 2004 election that there seemed to be a very concerted effort by social conservatives to get things like anti-gay measures on ballots in something like 10 or 12 states. as a way of driving their base. Is this a strategy that liberals have pursued in the past at all? And if not, why?
They have not pursued it as aggressively as many people think they should have. I mean, like you said, conservatives have been doing this, especially social conservatives and anti-gay initiatives, initiatives that restrict abortion, anti-affirmative action initiatives. 2008 saw Proposition 8, which banned same-sex marriage in California. And they've taken sort of a one-size-fits-all approach. You know, let's do it in this state and then go around to other states. And progressives haven't done that as much, in part because progressives have been, you know, focusing their money and resources elsewhere on getting individuals elected. They've been, you know, trying to target states more focused in more focused ways, or they've been just on the defense trying to defeat these initiatives. And progressives are now waking up and saying, look, we need to, these are really powerful. They have a lot of effect, and we need to start going on offense like conservatives have been doing.
So who is behind the sort of the national efforts on this? I mean, presumably, you know, in a state like Ohio, obviously there are state wide organizations that are doing this, and in Idaho, statewide organizations. But who, from a national perspective, who is who is leading this effort, and what exactly are they doing?
Well, first, let me say that it definitely is being driven by the organizations at the state level. And I think where the national organizations come in is to provide some coordination, to provide, you know, tips on what's going on. You know, hey, Ohio, look at what people in Maine are doing. And it's just maybe bringing in volunteers from elsewhere. But it's definitely being driven at the state. The Ballot Initiative Strategy Center, it's a progressive organization. They are trying to become more aggressive, coordinate what's going on, and just, you know, say, show progressives, you know, the lessons learned, what not to do, what to do, provide some resources. And, you know, also a big thing is convince funders that, you know, you need to be giving money to these campaigns to get on the ballot in addition to giving money to Democratic candidates to get elected. So it's convincing people that these are worth their money and their investment.
Are they having luck with that? I mean, I would imagine that there's a lot of I keep reading or hearing anecdotal stories about big Obama money supporters who are saying, like, you know, I've had enough. I'm getting out of politics. Forget it. I think I may just go buy an island, a floating island somewhere, or whatever it is. Is this organization having luck in terms of funders? Are they finding that in this environment there's a greater openness to funding these type of initiatives?
I think it's a little early to tell, and I think they're sort of just starting to work on this. I mean, where we're seeing a lot of the money come in right now is through the labor unions, and that's where some national support is coming in as well. National unions like the AFL-CIO, SEIU, AFSCME, you know, they're giving money to these pro-labor organizations to help get these ballot initiatives going. So I think it's a bit early, but we'll see. A lot of these ballot initiatives aren't going to be happening until 2012, although Ohio's is this November. But it will definitely be something to watch for if donors are saying, you know, we don't want to give our money here, we're going to give them to these ballot measures instead and these outside groups.
I imagine if the numbers of voters who come out in November of this year in Ohio is higher than one might anticipate, that's going to be a big argument, isn't it? Because I get the sense that the Obama 2012 reelection campaign is not going to have the same sort of free resources that it had in 2008. It's not going to have the same sort of energized base. And if the numbers from this Ohio thing are sort of eye-popping, I would imagine that people are going to adopt this strategy even more.
Absolutely. That it will be a huge motivator. And that's something that conservatives have done, too. Let's get these initiatives on the ballot. They'll drive the base out and get them gymmed up. And then hopefully people will then vote for more conservative candidates. And it works the other way, too. You know, if you have a good candidate, then more people will turn out to vote for the ballot initiative. So there's definitely a relationship between the ballot initiatives and the candidates that progressives are hoping to take advantage of and get people out in it to vote for them and vote for the Democratic candidates.
You mentioned that the conservatives have been pretty good at, like, these, you know, let's come up with one initiative that we can run in 10 states. Is there an equivalent? I mean, because, you know, the advantage I think the conservatives have is that there's always one or two social value issues that can work in 10 states, particularly within the, you know, the sort of the Republican, you know, sort of the red state, I guess, territory. You know, if you back in 2004, it was sort of a gimme for them. Oh, we just come up with some anti-gay measures and we'll be able to drive our base out to the polls in 12 different states. It seems to me that that's a harder calculation to make with progressives, because, you know, not every state has this attack on, let's say, labor that Ohio does. What would be that? Are they talking on a national level, like what those issues potentially could be?
Well, one thing would probably be gay marriage, and I guess it's sort of the opposite of what the conservatives were doing and trying to put forward initiatives against gay marriage, and progressives are going the other way. And so that's, you know, that's one thing we've seen pushed at ballot initiatives. We'll probably see pushed again in 2012. A few years back, we saw progressives pushing minimum wage measures, both at the state and the local levels, trying to get these referendums passed that would raise the minimum wage. So I think those are some ones that we're seeing. But you're right that conservatives certainly done this more. It seems a little bit easier for them, you know, abortion restrictions, affirmative action restrictions, easier to do a blanket across the board. But I think
why do you think that is? I'm having trouble coming up with something. You know, we can talk about the minimum wage, and I think, like, you know, all progressives would sort of, you know, say, oh, I have no problem with the minimum wage. But for most of those people, that they're, you know, unless they're working for the minimum wage, it's not necessarily an issue that is they could be passionate about. I mean, with gay marriage, I think that there's a little bit more across the board passion for this for progressives, particularly if the conservatives came out and really started talking about how much they didn't want it, because the way they talk about these things, I think, motivates people's sense of justice more. But I'm having trouble coming up with what is that measure that could work across 5 or 10 states.
Well, in some ways it's easier for conservatives, because a lot of times conservatives define themselves as what they're against. You know, we're
right.
Against your government, we're against higher taxes, we're against gay marriage, we're against, you know, cap and trade, and so you can therefore put forward ballot measures.
Brown people.
We're not going to do things like that. Progressives, you know, I think try to sort of say this is what we're for. And then when you try to say this is what we're for, then you have to adopt a specific measure that can work in that place. And that gets very tricky.
Yes, that's true. All right. Well, Amanda Turkel, thank you so much for joining us. It's a fascinating strategy. And I think, you know, as we go through this, I start to begin to, you know, contemplate the idea of the real battle, for progressives, at least in the near term, is at the state level. So I appreciate your coming on.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. Now, before we go, you people are so lucky. You freeloaders are so lucky. Because we're going to have time. I interviewed David Cross yesterday. I'll talk about the interview in the after show. And we'll play it sometime, I think, next week, maybe in pieces or whatnot. But we did talk about the earthquake. I will talk about it more in the better half of the show. But I will leave you with this brief exchange between David Cross and I yesterday about the earthquake, and then we will go to the better half of the show. All right. Well, first, David, we should say that we're recording this on Tuesday. Did you feel that earthquake today?
Yeah, I didn't hear it. Apparently you heard it, but I felt it, and it was really freaking me out, because my mind, I've been in a number of earthquakes in LA, and that was an earthquake, but I wasn't wrapping my head around the fact that this couldn't possibly be an earthquake in New York. And it was one of those rolling kinds.
Yeah.
So it lasted for, like, I mean, it must have been 25, 35 seconds.
Yes.
That's really long for an earthquake. And I have a, you know, a chair with wheels, you know, like an office chair in my office, and it's literally going from left to right. My doors are opening, you know, the closet doors, and Ollie's, my dog, is barking, and it was an earthquake, and I was like, all right, this can't be an earthquake. I'm in New York. What's going on?
You still live at that same place, right? Do you still live at the same place?
Yeah.
It was so freaky. I was on the toilet in our office bathroom, and I thought I was having some type of heart attack because I'm like watching the floor sort of like seem like undulate, and I'm just like going, oh God, man, I got to get more sleep. I'm like having like that thing where like you feel like you're rocking, and then I thought, wait a second, it's not me. There's going to be some type of explosion coming out of the toilet. Like I thought there was something like the, I thought the toilet seat was rumbling. And then, thank God, that was terrifying. Because it's not, but you know, I've been in them in L.A. In L.A., that's like part of, that's what happens there.
Right, right. And you also know that all the buildings are retrofitted.
Exactly.
And this was like the the Whittier quake, if you were in that one, as opposed to Northridge, which was a vertical quake. The Whittier was horizontal, so it was like really rolling, and it was like gentle shaking, you know, like somebody shaking you awake. But it lasted so long, and I was like, okay, this isn't the subway, this isn't something outside, and nobody else was reacting to it, and I was just having difficulty wrapping my brain around what I knew it was, which was an earthquake, but it just made no sense to me. And I was still sitting there for like almost the entire time.
There was enough
time to go, wait, I need to get out of here. What am I doing? You know, but this building is pre-war, so it's pretty, pretty sturdy, you know?
Well, we just had an elevator in this building crash down. And so I thought, like, oh, my God, the rest of the building, the infrastructure is going to fall apart. And I got my pants around my ankles, and this is going to be, like, doubly bad for me. Not just as the building.
Were you able to wipe, or was that not an option?
And that's what happened. So.
Nice. Very nice.
I don't have a fart machine on here, but. All right. Well, David, always a pleasure. And let's do this again.
All right.
All right, folks. That is. That's the not as good half of the show. The better half of the show is coming up next. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. 10th caller will get a guaranteed answer from me on the phones today. Folks, again, please become a member of the Majority Report. The show cannot continue. And the thing is that you will never get what you get here anywhere else. And when it's gone, you'll be like, I can't believe I just saved 33 cents a day. And I have that big chunk of my life just been ripped away from me. 33 cents a day. You know what's the worst feeling in the world? Regretting the fact that you didn't pay 33 cents a day for something that you enjoy every day. Is there anything you enjoy every day? Even four times a week? Three times a week? Once a week? That cost you 33 cents? Are you kidding me? Man, I gotta pay 15 bucks just to get for an hour just to get away from my kid. And you can support the show, of course, by going to Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. Fair trade. Organic if you want. Coffee, tea, chocolate. 10% discount, Majority, and the coupon code. You can donate your account so that those whippersnappers at Citizens Radio stop making fun of us for our dentures and our walkers. At donateyouraccount.com/MajorityFM. And, of course, you can buy your Amazon crap at our site at Majority FM. Click through the link and see it there. We get some kickbacks on that. Tomorrow on the show, at the very least, John Amato. We may even have another guest. We may double it up. All right, 646-257-3920 or the IM at Majority FM. See you on the better half.